From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 375, recorded live Thursday, June 6th, 2013. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support. Online at TELERIK.com. And by Franklins.net, makers of GesturePack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at GesturePak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Paul Betts and Justin Sparr-Summer about the culture of GitHub.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. I'm here in San Francisco at GitHub World Headquarters. World Headquarters until you move in a couple of days, I guess. I'm here with Paul Betts and Justin Sparr-Summers. How are you?
Not bad.
I wanted to talk to you guys about culture, because one of the things that I think is really interesting about GitHub is actually kind of two things. One, more people are remote than are in this office, which is weird, especially given that Yahoo is doing what Yahoo is doing around remote workers. But also, sloppy, but sloppy is not the word. You're loose, you're relaxed about what people are working on. Like, there's a focus and there's a laser focus on the mission. But at the same time, if someone really has a passion about something that they think will make the business better, you don't prevent them from doing that. So let's start with that. You have like all these pieces of software inside that you talked about, like chatbots and DJs and things that I would think have nothing to do with the business. How do you guys get to work on stuff like that?
Yeah, I think that, who said this? Michael Koziarski said it was like organized chaos at GitHub. That's about right.
But it works though. And that's the reason that's interesting. You see what I'm saying? Like if it was stupid, if it was sloppy, it wouldn't be GitHub. It would be a failed startup.
Yeah, that's true. I think that it, a lot of our developers talk about different reasons why this method works, and it's like, even though it's very surprising, I think the part of it is that we work on tools that we use to build the thing we're building, and so we immediately know what's bad about it and what's good about it, and we're all very focused on kind of bringing this mission of enabling open source and doing something awesome to the world. And so, like, when you're all focused on kind of the vision of what you're building, then this works, right? It doesn't work if 10 people have 10 ideas on what the company's doing as a whole, mm-hmm. right? And that's really a challenge, like, especially as you get bigger. Like, when it was 30 people, this was really easy. Your brains are kind of attached to each other at that size. But mm-hmm. when you get bigger, that's when it gets more challenging. And so we build software to make this easier for us, for sure.
And I think with respect to some of the projects you mentioned specifically, like, in particular, Hubot, like our chat client and stuff like that, a lot of them actually end up functioning for our business rather than just kind of being hobby projects. Like, mm-hmm. I think actually Hubot's an excellent example, because it started off as just kind of like, you know, fooling around, getting memes into chat and stuff like that. But now it's actually used by our ops team, for instance.
Well, if you don't mind, maybe the audience probably isn't familiar with Hubot and this intelligent agent that you've created. Maybe back up a little bit and start with you all in a chat room, and then mm-hmm. what happened?
So we're in a campfire chat room, basically. And Hubot is a node-based robot that is in every chat room and responds to commands, arbitrary commands. And we have one repo where everyone in the company can basically, it's kind of funny, but commit to master basically and add new scripts or modify scripts to do interesting things. And so a lot of times, you know, it's just for fun. It's again, like fooling around doing memes and stuff like that. But then, sure. then it started getting more interesting. It's like, well, what if we hooked up, you know, information about our file server load into chat? And that all that's starting to be done through Hubot.
So you're saying, like, if originally someone's in there and they say some keyword, Hubot jumps in and puts an animated GIF of that meme.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's like Hubot do whatever or slash do whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we have like a huge roster of built-in scripts that are mostly memes, but then there's more and more serious stuff too. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's interesting because the ops specific stuff, for instance, wouldn't have developed without it being a tool for fun first.
Right. If you said everyone will go into the chat room and here are the 12 commands that it understands.
Right.
Rah.
Yeah, like that, it would have never evolved as organically as it has now. Mm-hmm. And now it's like a hugely valuable part of our culture. Like when Hubot's not present in the chat, like we literally don't know what to do sometimes. It becomes a mayhem.
What are some functional things that Hubot does?
So, one thing he does is he allows you to deploy a branch. And this applies for many projects. It applies for GitHub.com as well as some of our internal tools and like GitHub for Windows. Basically, you can tell Hubot to deploy a branch to production or to staging or whatever the case may be. And it delegates out to another service that we have, but Hubot is the arbiter responsible for mm-hmm. starting that process.
It kicks it off.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, we use Hubot to control all of our virtual machine infrastructure. So I can use Hubot to create a virtual machine. And then everything at GitHub is automated. We go through this. We use a library application called Puppet to automate creating virtual machines. So when I create a virtual machine, it's not a blank one. It has a role and it's puppetized to be a new file server or a new front end. And so it'll immediately get created and Hubot will tell me the details of it. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about, doing things in that way is that you're learning from others implicitly in the sense that like if we built that into a dashboard, nobody else would see how, Jesse Newland figured out our one of our main ops guys figured out, you know, the solution to some bug. But because he did all this stuff in chat, and all the graphs he looked at to determine what was wrong and all the stuff were in the chat while he was talking about it. Mm-hmm. It means they can go back and see like, oh, that's how he did this and that. You know, that's how he checked for, you know, server load.
So if you went in and made a virtual machine now to test some feature, they would see it. They would see you doing it.
Yep.
Is it one big, giant, chaotic chat room?
Well, so there's a lot of different chat rooms. I think we have a huge amount. Like it's got to be like at least 50.
But isn't by having a lot of chat rooms that dilute the kind of sense of community?
A little bit, because they're organized by topic though. So if I'm doing ops stuff, I'm going to try to do it in the ops room. Mm. And so other ops people will be able to help me out. Or if I'm doing stuff related to, you know, Mac things, I'm going to be in the Mac room. Right. And so hopefully that'll be really, it tends to scope itself pretty well, at least at our size.
Mm-hmm. Justin?
There's certainly an aspect where, you end up with more of a community centered around your team, I think. So like what Paul was mentioning, like the Mac room, it's not just Mac work related stuff. Like it's also kind of a community within the Mac folks. But then there's also kind of general purpose chat rooms that are just for the company wide sense of community, like the danger room, which is basically the room of memes and talking about whatever. Mm-hmm. And so it's useful for the separation of like, you know, people working on different projects that don't necessarily have any overlap. It's valuable that they can go into one room and have all the related work stuff there. Mm-hmm. But then also you still get the opportunity to communicate with other people in the company just socially.
Do you guys use email anymore? Or is there literally like virtually no email flying around?
We use email sort of like internal blogging almost. So like if we're planning a big ship, for instance, like a new feature, an email will be sent out to the HAPS mailing list, which is kind of like things that are happening at GitHub from different teams that mm-hmm. you may not be aware of otherwise. But yeah, it's really not a discussion tool like it is at most companies.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to understand if there is any dysfunction here and what it is. I'll give you an example of some dysfunction at Microsoft. People use Outlook, which is our mail client, as chat. And by that, I mean that I could step away from my desk for 5 minutes, come back, and now the thread is like nested, forked, and 10 deep. And it's like one line at a time. And maybe it's age, maybe it's culture, but my perspective is pick up the darn phone at some point. Like just pick up the phone or walk to that person's cube. But by doing that, it makes the psychic weight of those emails is really pressing on your head.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting specifically with regard to that, because we actually kind of take the opposite approach, which is like everything should be logged. Like you should be able to go back into the past and see what happened. But with regard to your original question about...
Let me fork off of that for a second, because everything should be logged is great. But when you send an email, now you're putting a copy in everyone else's place, and then that it's sitting there until they choose to either archive it or or leave it in their inbox, which is different from logging stuff.
Well, yeah, that's certainly true. Like that's one of the reasons why we focus on Campfire Chat, where it's just like persistent chat logs that you can browse through at your discretion, or repository issues and things like that, where it's, if you're watching the repository, you do kind of get the notifications list, but it's not as forceful as email. I guess would be a good word to describe it.
Yeah. But is there a dysfunction? Like, does it just perfectly work? Is this magical? Should we all who are listening stop doing so much email and start spending more time in a persistent chat room?
I mean, I think that no matter what, you have the problem of information overload. So like at GitHub, I use the notifications a lot, like GitHub/notifications. But I still have, you know, a ton of information flowing through there. And like, you know, you can build any tool is going to have that problem, right? As soon as your projects get big enough, if you're paying attention to enough stuff, it's hard to keep up with. And so I think the bigger problem we work on at GitHub is trying not to miss stuff. And so our notifications are actually pretty good at that, because they're push notifications, and in the iPhone or Android app, you can see a list of them. They don't go away so easily, right? It's not like they're ephemeral, where it's like regular push notifications. You just push them away and they're gone, right? Mm-hmm. And so that helps a lot. And so it means that you can kind of use chat in a different way than you normally would. You would, like, if somebody's not around and I need to ask them a question, I just ask them a question and then move on, right? And eventually they'll wake up and I'll, you know, be asleep, or if they're, you know, in a way different time zone, and they'll answer the question and I might not even be there, right?
So even though that's scrolled back, that's going to show up. Are you talking about your Hubot chat room, or asking the question on GitHub itself?
In the Hubot chat room.
And how will they know? They were mentioned, and then that mention then gets pulled out off to the side as a notification.
Yep. And when they click the notification, they'll see the chat in context. You don't see just the line. You see like the section of what their people were talking about.
And how much of this is still Campfire, and how much of this is some kind of evil Campfire with a goatee that you've made?
It's hard to say. It's really like, it's pretty... So we added search. We index every message being sent into Elasticsearch. And so a lot of the superpowers that we have in chat are based on that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really Campfire search anymore. Campfire's API is leaves a lot to be desired. To put it mildly. We definitely built a lot of stuff. Like Campfire doesn't have push notifications. It doesn't have any.
So you just monkey patched all that stuff yourself.
We either added services that have like basically are watching every message and then recording them and then doing stuff based on them, or doing all kinds of crazy stuff.
Doesn't that seem like a product somebody ought to produce? I mean, like, you know, it's so funny that these things go, these utilities get built. Like you have Hubot, like I can go get Hubot, right? It's up on GitHub. But when you have your Campfire +++, that's your own thing, right? I can't go and get that.
It's certainly true. One of the things that we work on all the time is we have so many internal tools that are not really in a state to be released. Even just the tool that gives you the notifications that Paul was mentioning, like the team application, we call it. It's hugely useful for our organization, but it's not really in a state where we would be ready to release it as a product, because we're still in that stage where for everything like this, we're still exploring what exactly are the useful pieces to us, like what we would do or what the alternatives would be without it, what more would need to be there for other people to find it useful. The way we work at GitHub is so many interconnected things that it's often hard to extract a specific piece and make that useful to other people without having the rest of it too.
Well, that was my next question, that I think that on the Windows side, on the Windows/Microsoft side, we seem to want to centralize things. You know, like, I've got this utility and this utility and this utility, and a Windows person will look at that and say, ah, I will make the integrated thing for that, and I shall call it SharePoint. And then it will be one great, wonderful thing. Well, I think that the Mac, Unix, and I say Mac, Unix, because there's, like, the Mac culture that appreciates the aesthetic of Mac, the like, I like PNGs, and then there's the I like command line person, and they happen to be similar people because... Sure. They want to break the thing apart into little reusable pieces. So I'm hearing you say that GitHub is a bunch of little reusable pieces that like to talk to each other.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
GitHub, like, the organization.
Yeah, unreservedly. The problem, of course, with that is that it's hard to tell whether the piece itself is useful or the sum total of them is useful. And it's hard to open things up in pieces like that if you don't really know the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. It also seems a little overwhelming. Every time I talk to Paul or Phil Hack or people I know at GitHub, I get this sense of like, there's shorthand and there's acronyms and there's codes and there's short codes. It's like SED and AUK as an organization, like, you know, welcome to now learn regular expressions. And that just seems very difficult. Like, how do you onboard people, especially remote people who are just overwhelmed by the toolkit that you have?
So I think one, I'm actually not in the San Francisco office, so I might not know the answer to the question.
That's a good question. So where are you?
So I'm in Seattle. Okay. Yeah, I'm one of those more than half of the remote people.
Okay. You're here now though, cause I can see you.
Yeah. Yeah. But so one way we solve this is I believe we have a dedicated person who onboards people, which helps. Like they just walk people through. That's literally a full-time responsibility.
That's a really cool idea.
Yeah. And then the other part is, I mean, it is overwhelming. There's definitely a fire hose. Like everyone's first week is just like mayhem. Like all this information.
Right. Like I'm not supposed to be here.
Yeah, exactly. But then there are specific guides constructed for new people. There's all this like history in each project, like development process. I mean, archive chats, archive talks, that sort of thing, that are specifically meant to improve this problem because it's not just a, it's not just when you're new to the company. It can also be when you're new to the team, you may not understand everything that's going on and you may need to get up to speed on that specific team's culture.
Context.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So even once people are hired, we still have that problem when they're moving between teams. And so we're actively trying to solve that. And in solving that, it helps with new company hires as well.
And as a piece of context for the listener, if I'm correct, you work on GitHub for Windows and you work on GitHub for Mac.
Correct.
So good that we've got the both of you here.
Yeah.
Did you have a thought about that?
Yeah. I mean, like, onboarding is definitely something we put a lot of effort into. We fly, these days we have everyone come down for at least a week, when they start on their first day. So they get a chance to meet people in person and kind of move a little faster than if they were trying to do everything remote. Like I started at GitHub very early. Like my first day at GitHub was me sitting on my couch till like 2 PM when they like created the campfire credentials for me. So I was like, hey guys, did I really start at this company? Am I unemployed now?
That's
like,
not ideal then.
That No. It was very bad. We didn't know what we were doing back then, but now we're much better. So yeah, I mean, we definitely have a much, it's not formalized, but you definitely have a lot of, you have a list of stuff you should do the first day. And we always like make sure that every new employee has kind of like, not a mentor, but like somebody to like ask questions, like any, you know, somebody that they are specifically assigned to, like, they can go to this person.
And that person won't laugh at them when they ask a stupid question.
Yeah. And well, and the other person is kind of on the hook to make sure that this new hire does well, or not does well, but like does, you know, knows what they're doing, doesn't feel lost, stuff like that. So
interesting. So we've talked about tools and toolkits and how you're enabling people to build these though. Like if you had an idea for the great new tool, and you're going, I'm going to go build tool. How do you work that into your existing workload? And how do you make it happen?
We just kind of do it. I don't know. Like step one, come up with a cool idea. Step two, build the cool idea. I think that it obviously depends on, what you're working on at the time. It's kind of not, you know, you try not to, like, if I know that I'm, you know, all my coworkers are trying to ship something, then I'm not going to just, you know, jump off and be like, I'm going to work on this side project. So, but I think people just generally, know what to do. And like, you know, it really relies on, people knowing what's important at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So personal responsibility. What do you think, Justin?
So I definitely think there's no point in which you're abandoning your current team. Like you do try to get to a good state with them, like Paul mentioned. And then there's kind of the flip side of that, which is once you've started on your new thing, there's kind of this, controlling social effect where it's like, if you can't get other people bought into your idea for this new thing, like they won't join you. They won't want to help out and it'll just kind of fizzle out naturally almost. Mm.
Does that happen?
Yeah,
it does. Have there been like ideas that have been built and thrown in and people just didn't go for it?
I won't say they usually don't get built out all the way. It's usually like, I have this idea. I have this vision. Mm-hmm. I communicate it to my fellow employees and some of them say, oh, that's kind of interesting. Maybe they work on it a little bit and turns out it's not actually as interesting as it was originally. Or maybe people just don't respond with enthusiasm to the idea at all. And that's perfectly okay, acceptable and expected many times. It's just like, okay, so I guess that means that I was the only one excited about that, and it's not actually that great an idea.
Without naming and shaming, can you think of any ideas that might be, that were like, hey, you know, on paper, this was a good idea, but the community, for whatever reason, didn't go for it? Because the reason I asked that is that as you were giving me the tour, Paul, there's a giant 100-inch touchscreen. It's like a Surface Plus Plus out there. And what's interesting about it is there's little squares with people's faces of where they are. And I'm like, oh my goodness, that's amazing. You can tell where everyone is. And then I'm thinking, well, how is that possible? They're going to need to opt in. They're going to want to run some kind of a little app. And you said that they're actually pulling that from a number of different places. When they chat, well, you grab it from the geolocation of their browser. And if they happen to be on Foursquare, we pull it from there. So you're doing that implicitly, which means that they don't have any additional mental baggage or any psychic weight associated with that. So the entire company now is locatable on a map without anyone having to do anything about it, which means, from my perspective, that's an idea that's just going to work. You know, no one had to push any buttons. Are there any tools that are failing right now or any ideas that just never made it happen? Or are you guys just awesome and you nailed them all? You're like looking up like, I can't think of any ideas that we've come up with that have not succeeded dramatically.
You all. Yeah. I think the one thing that we keep trying to build something good around and we'll kind of get there, but not completely, is GitHub for mobile phone, like iOS or Android.
There's lots of GitHub clients. There's people attempting to do it.
Yeah. It always seems like, that's the thing, is like when you go to build it, it always seems like this is going to be amazing. Like I'm going to do all this stuff on my phone. It's like, well, it turns out that people don't want a code review on their phone. Like,
I don't know, man. I'll tell you this. In the last 24 hours, I've accepted 5 different pull requests to a project I'm working on, doing it in landscape because you guys don't have a mobile responsive view. And I've been using one called Giddy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the latest one from, I think, Matthew Strickland.
And everything's great about it, except the notifications pile up, and I don't know how to make them stop. I want the, you know, and this is the thing with all notifications. There's the individual marking as red, and I just, notification bankruptcy, which is what I need. I should get an achievement in the game center for every time I push clear. You know what I mean? Because I don't care anymore. Mark all as red. So, yeah. So that was that why there is no mobile GitHub?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I just think that, like, from a workflow perspective, it's one of those things that ends up being not sticky once people use it.
But see, it sounds to me like, and then we're getting a little off topic, but it seems like people at GitHub wouldn't use a mobile GitHub client, but arguably the people in the real world would.
That's true, because they have way less notifications.
So then that means that you're not serving your business user because y'all, as a culture, aren't going for it.
Well, I think part of it is just there are a lot of ways to skin that cat, and it's hard to you're not only trying to get people on board with the idea of doing something on mobile, but also the specific way of doing something on mobile. And a lot of times that, I think, is what's fallen through, is like people have disparate ideas about what it should be, and it's hard to get coordinated effort on one of those if not everyone's agreeing. But I think also with respect to the idea of like ideas failing, I think a lot of them are not actually outright failures, as in they get completely abandoned and never looked at again, but many of them turn into kind of like culture tool things or like internal tools that are not really, I want to say not actively maintained, but that sounds bad, but like, it's kind of like a one end.
Fundamental.
What's that?
They're not fundamental.
Not fundamental.
Like Hubot is like, welcome to GitHub. This is Hubot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's kind of like maybe they would languish or, they get used, but they don't get, it was like maybe a weekend hack project or a week hack project, and mm-hmm. no one really wanted to pick it up after that or stuff like that. But then, you know, eventually if people do pick up usage of it, and it gets more widely, people get enthusiastic about the idea of something better, then it'll get steam again, maybe get rebooted. I feel like that's sort of what happened with, Play, which is our like kind of internal, music system.
Yeah, I noticed there's no music. Somehow I just assumed that there would be like, it'd be like a dance party in here. Cause that's the sense I get when I watch like Zach Coleman's talks. It's like, oh, it's a constant dance party.
Yeah. Well, I think right now it's from trying to keep the noise down, but, but like for a while there was just the one version of Play, and it was kind of there because the people that had been working on it, moved to other things, and not because they disliked it, but just because those other things took priority or were more important.
Well, I've got at Microsoft, I have a portal that's like a camera that's I try to keep on all the time, but it's amazing how little pieces of friction will completely derail something.
Sure.
So like, something expired on the like this password or whatever. And then 2 weeks goes by and the portal hasn't been on in 2 weeks, right? And then somebody gets around to fixing it. And then it's back on. I'm like, yeah, this was a great idea. Why did we ever stop using this? And then, you know, a service pack doesn't get, you know, installed, and then it's down for another week, and it's down right now because the hard drive is failing, right? So it's like something that is so fundamental to my life as a remote employee goes away and I'm still alive and somehow I'm still doing my job. Was it really that important?
It's a good question. Actually, there was an article an interview recently with Chrissy Brodigan, who is our UX research person.
Mm-hmm.
And she basically described this style of testing that we're starting to do more of, which is deprivation testing. So it's like the idea that if you take away a feature or a product or something along those lines, you see what the response is. Like if people are really outraged about it, you're like, oh, that's actually pretty useful. But if it's just kind of like a phase into the night quietly, then it's like, well, okay, I guess we don't actually need to work on this anymore because no one really cared.
Wow. You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. Just as an aside, the menus in Visual Studio, our IDE, is just completely out of control. And every team wants their thing to be up front. So in a world where people care and work as a team, it would be like right click, add, and then that would fly out and then add, here are all the choices. But everyone keeps wanting to be the one that's up front. So it's like, add this, add this, add this unrelated thing. And they're all like up top. And I said, listen, guys, let's just really like rip the Band-Aid off. Let's just cut the menu down by like 50%. And if anyone yells, then we'll add it back. And mm-hmm. No, we can't do that. I love that word, deprivation testing.
Yeah. And
yeah,
so
just yank it out, see if anybody screams.
Right. And so mainly it's in the context of like controlled user research right now. But like to some extent, that's happened with larger features too. Like maybe the most atrocious example in relatively recent times is the fork queue, like, got removed, and very few people complained about it because it got replaced.
I don't know what that is. What is that?
The fork queue was a way to see, so you have like your repo and then all the repos in what we call a network. So like their forks and their forks forks. And
that page is so slow, I don't even visit it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
The fork queue.
It's really slow.
Yeah. We're working on it. I told you, we ran out of space. We have no room for computers.
It's like 2 minutes. I'm like, just open a tab and come forget about it.
Yeah. So the fork queue lets you see commits from other repos.
Okay.
But it was from the very, very early days of GitHub, and it was not designed so well. And so I think most people did not miss it or did not even notice it disappearing.
But you think if Hubot went away, remotes would be have a problem. Like back to remote, you're in Seattle, Phil hacks in Seattle. Your chat room is really where you're not Skyping people, right? You're not video chatting. Your connection to this office is Hubot. So that's something that you couldn't live without.
Yeah, exactly.
Is team.
Right. And that's like everyone is 100% aware of that. Like we would never try a day without Hubot because we know that it's an incredibly integral part of our workflow. Like mm-hmm. there's not even any question. Like that's not a question that needs answering. This is more for like maybe features on the website or features in our native apps where it's like, well, it doesn't seem like it gets used that much. Maybe we can try going without it. And, you know, we don't have to maintain it. Then we don't have to, you know, keep this code around. And depending on the response, it either stays there or mm-hmm. it gets removed permanently.
There was a lot of discussion around when Marissa Mayer was like, yeah, everyone from Yahoo, you know, come into the mothership now. And people kept saying, how do you know if a remote person's not just goofing around? And that seemed like it was more interesting to me than the other discussions around remote workers, is that are you measuring whether or not your people are working or not? I mean, presumably, if you have a boss, I don't know how flat you guys are here, they would look at your commits and they would look at your output and the fact that you shipped on time or you didn't. And they go, yeah, Justin's doing a good job. You can see. I haven't seen him for a year, but the work product is there.
Yeah. So we are extremely flat organization. So there isn't really a person in that role that would do that kind of reviewing. It's really kind of team oriented where it's just like
Well, how do you know who's last in their class at Harvard, right? I mean, everyone's at GitHub. Yeah. Right. We're all at Harvard.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to be the one that sucked.
Well, it's true, but it's also not measurable in any ways. Like, I mean, we could measure commits, we could measure lines added and removed, but that still doesn't tell you anything.
Well, yeah, I mean, measuring lines of code is silly. But how do you know who gets the big bonus and who gets the small bonus?
I mean, it's a team effort. There wouldn't be one person that would get an outrageous bonus while everyone else didn't. Like, it's really, you can't. So your example of like someone disappearing for a year, oh, you still know they're productive because they've got all these commits coming in. Like, if you're working on a team, you can't disappear for a year. Like, your code is valuable, but your presence is also valuable. And so
in the chat.
Yeah. Like being, I mean, not necessarily at the same time as everyone else, but being available for questions, for discussions with the rest of your team. Like, it's not just about the code you write. It's also mm-hmm. about, you know, the kind of social aspect or the vision aspect of the team, like contributing to that.
Do you as a remote, and kind of talking remote to remote here, that I have a sense of, that fear is almost too big of a word, but there's just this sense of like, I hope that they know I'm working.
Mm-hmm. That was one of my big concerns before starting. And I think it was very quickly alleviated because while we don't use data to tell us whether someone's a good worker, you do have data on what's happening and what people are doing. So it's like, it's not a, you know, like they're productive or they're unproductive, but you can see the ways in which everyone is productive.
Mm-hmm.
So like we can go to repositories now and use the pulse feature, which we just recently made public, to see like the commits that are being made recently, the pull requests and issues that are open and being discussed. It's very transparent into what everyone's working on, even if, I don't know, like different levels of productivity aside, you can see what's happening.
And I hear about people at Microsoft being told by their bosses, like, you know, you really need to start thinking about moving to Seattle. That hasn't happened to me yet, but that fear of like, I'm, you know, to use an inappropriate metaphor, 3/5 of an employee.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever get that sense or do you feel 100% secure in your gig?
In terms of the things I work on, I feel totally secure about that. It's actually, I think the biggest advantage to living in San Francisco is missing or being around for all the culture or all the social activities. Like, you know, you can approximate it to some extent with like the shared chat room stuff. But
yeah.
At the end of the day, there are social things that you don't get remotely.
Yeah. In Seattle, I'm in Portland and in Seattle, like they went to Iron Man and they're going to Superman next week mm-hmm. and they go bowling. And there's always that kind of like, always a bridesmaid.
Yeah.
Kind of a sense when you see the mail go out to all hands and you're like, tentative. You know, I was like, maybe. I was like, I never click no, I'm not coming. Like, I might fly up to Superman. Yeah. I have no idea.
Yeah. Yeah. There's certainly a sense of, like, if I were to move to San Francisco, that would be the main reason I would want to do it.
Yeah.
But it's not because, like, even, like, no one else on my team lives here currently, although someone is moving here shortly. But so there's not this sense of like I'm missing out on important team discussions or important work. It would just be to be around other GitHubers.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything you want to say in conclusion, Paul?
Yeah, I was thinking about going back to the one of our biggest challenges of like, you know, finding the last person in the class or whatever is more not so much people directly not being productive, but not knowing where to contribute. So we've had in the past, like people kind of get kind of lost. Like they're like, oh, people just kind of poke at these little things and they're not, it's sometimes they don't feel empowered to do, mm-hmm. You know, something big or they're, you know, they don't think to do it. They're like, you know, not ambitious enough.
It sounds like that you're saying that they don't feel that they're able to do something or empowered so that they come off as being unfocused and not, enabled.
Yeah, or they're kind of used to other jobs where like, you know, they had to get a manager and a manager's and a manager's approval before they could do anything, right? And so they're like, oh yeah, of course I couldn't.
Right. And that would manifest itself as tentative behavior.
Like, yeah, I, of course I couldn't build this, you know, big thing, you know, or get this project started, like, you know, mm-hmm. and people aren't used to being able to just say like, yeah, let's do it. So that's definitely something that we have to try to watch out for, mm-hmm. and we try to do that by having at least when people start a very concrete idea of what they're working on. So like you're going to work on, you know, this is a thing you could work on, and you know we make sure they're excited about it and they want to work on that. And so I think that helps a lot.
Yeah, I think feeling empowered and feeling secure is what empowered is what the tools and the culture provide, and feeling secure is what the culture provides. And it's great that you're able to work remotely and I still have a job. Thanks so much, Paul and Justin, for chatting with me today.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for having us.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes. We'll see you again next week.